What's the Portlandia thing? The Dream of the 90s is alive in horror.
Oh, that didn't work.
Well,
consider cutting that.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Back on the podcast again. He was on a boat, now he's on dry land. Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
Yes, yeah. So Ashley and I, we went to New York, we saw some friends in New York, and then from there we took a Disney cruise up to Canada. We went to St. John, New Brunswick, spent a little time there, and now we're home in sunny California. We actually are on the way back. Our cruise had to kind of skirt around Hurricane Michael. So there was a moment that was like a little scary.
Yeah. It was like almost the perfect storm.
Yeah.
But he lived
well,
through it.
It was like one night the ship captain came on the loudspeaker and was like, and just so everyone's aware, tomorrow we're going to do our best to avoid Hurricane Michael, but you never know with these things, so we'll see what happens. And we were just like, oh, Jesus Christ.
And you look over at a very, very despondent Pluto.
No, it was fine. I mean,
Minnie Mouse has her hands and on our mouth going like, oh my, kind of gesture.
No, it was fine. We just had, you know, it was a rocky day coming back, but it wasn't like crazy.
Okay. Now last week you were not here. I had on our old film professor.
And I take umbrage with the fact that neither of you mentioned The Shining.
Okay.
I know you mentioned it later. But I was, like, listening to the episode, seriously going, what the fuck?
You thought it was just, like, no, literally, so last week, we've been doing, week by week, we've been doing our horror movie decade drafts. We did the 70s with you a few weeks ago. We did the 80s with Brandon last week. This week, we'll be doing the 90s. And when I put my list together, my short list, I was, you know, typing this thing in my phone kind of as I was thinking about them during the day. And for whatever reason, The Shining, one of my favorite movies of all time, by one of my favorite directors of all time, somehow slipped my mind.
Right.
But I think it was because I had my headspace in distinctly 80s aesthetics. And that movie doesn't really have that. It's still kind of has a 70s aesthetic.
Yeah, I actually was going to put it in my 70s draft, but I had to look it up.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that was an 80s movie? Because it's like 1980. It's right on the line.
Right. And the 80s as an aesthetic doesn't really kind of get going till about 82.
Yeah.
Some decades start right away, and the 80s starts pretty early. But I felt like a jackanape for forgetting about it.
You should. You absolutely fucking should. I also, there are a couple movies that I like to just give like an honorable mention to.
For sure.
Aliens, the sequel to Alien. And now you could make the case that it's more of a sci-fi action flick.
Yeah.
But
it's a monster movie.
Yeah, and we did talk, you know, we've talked so much about the Alien franchise already, but I still feel like it's worth, it maybe not top 10, but I feel like it's worth an honorable mention. Same goes for the original Predator. Where the whole AVP mess came from.
Uh-huh.
We should have just left it in the 80s. And then one more that's not really, I don't know if you could really call it a horror movie, but it's one of my favorite Halloween movies.
Okay.
It's sort of a kid's horror movie, The Monster Squad.
Yeah. So there was like, I think we talked a little bit at the end about like horror adjacent. And like that is kind of in the same world as like Gremlins in and
what see, was I think Gremlins full on fucking counts as a horror movie. That yeah. I mean it's a horror comedy, but yeah, it does have like a Christmas
thing vibe. Yeah, and a Steven Spielberg cute animal thing.
Yeah. But Monster Squad I feel like deserves an honorable mention because I think it's the best Halloween movie of all time.
That is a bold statement.
So. I mean, I grew up with it. You know, it's definitely got a lot of a nostalgia factor, but I think it holds up. It's sort of a predecessor to the like movies like The Mummy that are sort of
You're talking about the Stephen Sommers The Mummy, not like the old.
Yeah, the Universal. The one with Brendan Fraser. How it's, you know, sort of an action monster movie.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like nobody has done it as well as Fred Dekker and Shane Black did.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a fun movie. It's my Goonies.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get in the 90s.
So I think... Have you gone first yet in this horror draft?
No, this will be the first time I do. But I did want to preface this a little bit by saying, like, you know, to talk a little bit about the decade as a whole. This is kind of an interesting decade for horror. Horror fans generally kind of consider the 90s a bit of a dark period for horror. And not dark as in, like, spooky, but, like, a period of sort of inactivity. We see the rise of the thriller in the 90s. It kind of takes its place for a decade or so. We see the rise of like stuff like action monster movies, more so in the Independence Day vein.
A lot of teen horror.
Well, there we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But there's a little spike towards the middle of the decade of, you know, sort of a return to the slasher thing. But before that point, it was especially slow. And the bulk of what we see horror-wise that comes out is bad sequels to predecessors from the 80s.
That's true.
That is a lot of what comes out. There is kind of, however, when I put my list together and I thought like, oh man, there's going to be like five I can think of off the top of my head. And then the rest are going to be like borderline. But I did put together a better list than I thought I would. And
some of the stuff I agree with everything.
But they're not like unlike the other decades, the horror films that stand out in the 90s are not in concert with each other. They're not really like telling one like this is what 90s horror is about. It's sure. like this cool movie from over there, then this cool movie kind of happening over here, and they're from different scenes, different cultures, different film styles, different kinds of directors. It's just a lot more varied and a little bit more annexed into their own worlds.
Yeah, I can see that. But there's some gems.
Yeah, and we'll get into it. Let's go ahead and start it off. And it is finally my turn. I am going to go with my first one. I'm going to go with... You know, I think just to get it out of the way and to kind of kick off what I was talking about, Silence of the Lambs.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, don't fucking pull a Shining here.
No, this one and I definitely...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, one of my all-time favorite movies. I watched this perennially. This was a game changer. You know, a lot of movies say they're a game changer. This one actually was. This was one of those movies that was copied endlessly throughout the rest of the decade, both to good and bad effect. Made stars out of people like Anthony Hopkins, who had been working in Hollywood for a long time, but never really quite got out of the character actor game until that movie. It was directed by Jonathan Demme, who up until that point was mostly known for comedies like Married with the Mob and Something Wild. And then he goes, makes this dark horror noir hybrid based on a Thomas Harris novel, kind of airport fiction, and elevates it. He understands the tropes. He understands the appeal of sort of these type of detective movies, and brings a kind of reality to it that we hadn't seen up to that point. And, you know, on top of all of the reasons why it's a good genre film, and I think it is one of the best, it's also really a sophisticated statement on feminism. I think it's one of the most overtly feminist films, you know, mainstream films ever made, without it, like, jumping out in front of the camera and saying, this is what I'm about. While at the same time having some less than progressive ideas about, you know, transphobia and that kind of stuff. There's a bit of that.
Let's talk about that for a minute.
Okay.
Because
I don't hold it against the movie. I don't look at the movie and go, now. I mean, I understand that's it's coming from a tradition of things like Psycho and Texas also, Chainsaw and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, also, you know, a tradition of, you know, real life issues with serial killers. Like, a lot of, I think this is one of the first movies that I've seen that deals with the compulsion of serial killing as a sexual act. Related to sexuality, which often, you know, has some case with reality. So, and I'm not trying to say, you know, obviously not all trans people are killers. In fact, I would say most of them are not.
Clarice Starling would say most of them are not in the movie.
Yeah. So I can definitely see how that could be perceived, especially in this day and age when everybody's very sensitive about every possible issue. But I think it handles it because it's so based in I don't know. I'm talking myself into a hole. I'm just going to shut the fuck up. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And believe me, you know, I've watched the movie through my entire life and have come to several different conclusions about that specific aspect of the movie, the character of Buffalo Bill, how he's portrayed and da da da. And I've been on every side of that issue, but I think, you know, at the time it's something that kind of meant something different than it does now, because at the time, homosexuality and LGBT audiences didn't really have any other portrayal of them on screen other than killers.
Yeah.
And or victims. And that's why at the time it, you know, there was rioting and picketing and that stuff outside of the Academy Awards. And that's why Jonathan Demme's next film would be Philadelphia.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
But yeah, you know, beyond all of that, it's a really effective horror film, great performances, super dark, and still holds up. He knew not to stylize it to such a point that 5 years later it would seem dated.
Yeah, it kind of what you were saying about Carrie, like, it's definitely of the period it's from, but it feels more like a time capsule than anything else. It doesn't feel dated. It feels like, yeah, this is, like, things like this happened then.
All right. What's your first movie?
All right. I'm going to get the other big one out of the way. On the opposite end of the spectrum, the movie that revitalized the teen slasher movie.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, I'm just getting it. The big guns, Scream. I think for my money, I think this is probably the best slasher film ever made.
There's a good argument for that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so aware. And, you know, I haven't seen it in a long time. Maybe it dates a little more than I realize.
A little.
But it's just, it's a fun movie, too. That's the thing that I really enjoyed about this movie. This was one of the first, like, overtly horror movies that I saw that I could watch,
right?
Because there's enough tonal balance that you're entertained and horrified at the same time.
Yeah.
And a lot of this I attribute to Jamie Kennedy. He's but not just him. It's actually got a pretty good.
That's an incredible cast. And it's one of those casts where at the time, you know, none of these people were very well known at all. I mean, it's a lot of them came from TV, like Neve Campbell. You have Drew Barrymore is the biggest star in the film, and spoiler alert, dies in the first 5 minutes. And you know, obviously, it's kind of a Hitchcock nod and that kind of thing, but. No, yeah, this is, you know, this is this week's Wes Craven entry, and for good reason. He was kind of getting bored of horror at this point in his career. He'd done it his whole life. He kind of got pigeonholed into doing a genre that he wasn't even himself necessarily a big fan of, but he somehow became a horror master. And somebody came up to him at a festival or something like that and said, when are you going to make another movie like Last House on the Left? And he suddenly had all this guilt. It's like, oh my God, I've lost my edge. And that's when he went out and found the script for Scream. And I think the reason why you immediately sort of think about Jamie Kennedy is because he's the audience's surrogate. He's the person who's pointing out everything. It's like, this is like a horror film. And, you know, everybody talks about how this movie was like one of the first like meta texts in horror, where they're really kind of dissecting and decoding the horror tropes on screen for comedic effect.
I think even more than that, it's one of the first movies where the characters are aware of
the rules.
And we'll see this more and more in future decades, mm-hmm. where the characters are aware of what's going on around them. But I think that adds to both some of the fun of the movie and some of the suspense.
Yeah. I mean, there's a genuine kind of, and I think it's played down too much when people talk about the movie, but there's a genuine kind of whodunit mystery in this as well. It's you're trying to figure out who it is and throughout the whole movie and the way that they set up the red herrings and that kind of thing. That's all done very, very well too. And I think that plays a large part of why the movie is as entertaining as it is to watch. It kind of,
and it's fun to see because this movie kind of turns the stupid victim girl cliche on its head as well. Like Neve Campbell is a very capable character, and that's refreshing to watch. But it's also not. I keep wanting to stress the fact that this is such a fun movie, too.
Yeah, it's very poppy.
Like, he does all of this stuff, and he wraps it up in a very commercial, very pleasing-to-watch product with a new horror icon, the ghost-faced killer, in a time when that genre was getting so tired. Because, like you said, up to this point, it was all sequels to Halloween and all sequels to Friday the 13th. So it was just a really refreshing take on a pretty worn out genre.
For sure. Yeah. And, you know, this film, along with the last film we talked about, Silence of the Lambs, I think sort of defined the decade as far as what we would see being pumped out.
Very sort of adult, thrillery Silence of the Lambs copies, or very like poppy, pulpy,
teen,
MTV cut.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So let's go with something a little bit different. I'm going to go with end of the decade, 1999, Japanese film, Audition.
Okay.
This is a film that kind of didn't really get big in America until years later through word of mouth. So this, in some regards, people kind of maybe think of this as being a 2000s film. Also, this was kind of right around the time that J-horror was starting to bubble up and get co-opted by American studios. But this film, directed by Takashi Miike, is a psychological horror film about a girl who gets tricked into doing a fake audition to meet an older man. They have a little bit of a fling or a relationship. She feels spurned and takes things into her own hands. And it's kind of a take on movies that we've seen done in America, films like Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction and that kind of thing, but done with this entirely different cultural perspective. And there's these torture scenes in the movie that are so slow and drawn out and detailed and weirdly specific in the methods, and something that could only be done out of the U.S. And I think there is more surrealism in this movie than people normally talk about. I think people kind of talk about it as being like this shocker of a film. But it is, I think, largely a psychodrama. And there's even question as to the worst things we see on screen. Are they happening or not? I think it's a much more intelligent film than people tend to think of it as being. And I think it, as a study of tension, you know, one of the best.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know why. There's something in my brain when I'm coming up with these lists.
Mm-hmm.
I generally sort of discount foreign films, like, I think after the 70s, mm-hmm. maybe it's the 80s. I don't know. There's just a point when I saw Audition. I've seen, I think, the original Ju-on. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen some of these original sort of J-pop horror. But I don't know. There's just something about them that I don't really consider when I think of stuff like this. And, I mean, Audition, you know, I think it's a valid entry for all the reasons you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, it just doesn't pop to mind for me. And maybe it's just because when I think of horror movies in the 90s, you know, this was around the period of time when I was starting to sort of pay more attention to horror movies in my life, because we right. were sort of that age.
Yeah, early 20s or whatever. Yeah.
In the 90s?
Well, no, this came out in 1999, but we didn't see it probably until 2003 or something.
Late teens. So that's, you know, that's about the so to me, when I think of the 90s specifically, I think of the stuff that I saw, you know, trailers for and stuff that I saw in the movie store. And so yeah, a lot of that, you know, a lot of overseas stuff we wouldn't see in KB or whatever. So
right.
Maybe that's why it just doesn't.
No, that's fair enough. I you know, like, this isn't a movie necessarily that we grew up with, but there's a lot of the movies on my list that I saw much later. But sure. I have to acknowledge, especially since the other list we did didn't go into foreign as much. I think Japanese horror is such a big, big chunk of what's going on in extreme horror. And this one, I think, is
the 2000s,
especially, yes. But I think this one is quality wise better than most.
Yeah, that's fair. That's
and Takashi Miike's made other movies. You know, he's done traditional, like, Edo period samurai film, and he's done gangster films, and he's done every kind of film because he makes, like, three a year. But yeah. But this, I think, is, you know, one of the ones that crossed over big time for a reason.
Okay. So, my turn now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which way do I want to go? When I was putting my list together, I was trying to think of sort of what I do consider the seminal films of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely had Silence of the Lambs, I had Scream, and I think my next one, I'm just going to go with another movie that this genre definitely saturated the 90s movies, and that is the vampire movies. I'm talking about, in my opinion, the movie that sort of is still my definition of what I want a vampire to be,
mm-hmm.
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh, interesting. That is not the one that I thought you were going to say, but...
I think I know the one. That one might pop up later. But yeah, I mean, vampires, I'm looking at my list and I have at least 4 vampire movies as like potential to be on my list. They were huge in the 90s. And this was when they were, you know, before Twilight neutered them.
Yeah.
This was when they were sexual and threatening. And it was like, I remember like vampire movies were cool to me because there was something so adult about them. Like, uh-huh. Because there's always this element of sex, and they have some of the best 90s sex scenes that are out there. And it just, it felt...
We're learning a lot about Keith on this episode.
Well, they felt more dangerous because of that. I don't know why.
Yeah, there's a certain salaciousness that weaved into the mythology.
Yeah, because it wasn't just violence. Like, you know, I'd seen plenty of violent movies, but these... there was a sexual quality to the violence,
right? And sort of a seductive quality. So it's a thing that you're supposed to be scared of, that is dangerous, but it also is drawing you in and playing upon your lizard brain, essentially. And that's what kind of, you know, things that most people find the most terrifying is when it makes you uncomfortably close to the thing you're supposed to be scared of.
Fair enough.
And I think that sort of seductive quality of the vampire, you know, not all the time, but a lot of the time, is what kind of makes them as a creature enduring.
Yeah, and terrifying. And that's why
I think you have to defend Bram Stoker's Dracula a little bit, because it is not a well-loved film. I like the movie. I think it has great production design. I think there's a smattering of good performances, kind of scattered around some not so great ones.
Yeah, sure. Keanu Reeves, we all know.
And Winona Ryder. The leads of the movie have some issues.
but I think you kind of make up for that with Gary Oldman and
Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Again, Anthony Hopkins,
yeah.
Fucking making the list. I don't know. Maybe it's partially a nostalgia thing, but there's something so weird about this movie. Mm-hmm. It's so the set designs are just gorgeous.
The costumes?
Art direction of this movie. Like, I still think of Gary Oldman at the beginning in the fucking red robe and the creepy white, pale, desiccated form.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something so, like, wrong about it.
Yeah.
So I do think this movie has some issues story-wise with the third act, because it gets so dreamlike.
It's a little long.
It sort of becomes... Like, yeah.
It's a little long. It has some pacing issues.
And it does become a little indecipherable near the end.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also just something so cathartic, and again, when we're talking about Halloween, so Halloween about it to me. I don't know, just something about this movie and the sympathetic nature of Gary Oldman's performance is, I think, something that's a little strange too. You do sort of feel for him, you know. It is a romance movie, and you know, then he transforms into one of the most hideous monsters you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
So there's something that works on that level. And I think there's some interesting things being said about, you know, who is the actual villain? Is it this bloodthirsty monster or you know, some of the way the humans around Mina are portrayed seem just as vicious at times. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just something about this movie just kind of stuck with.
Well, I know that this is directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And I think a lot large reason why the blowback on this film was as hard as it was is because it was done by the guy who did The Godfathers. And I think this is either right before or right after Godfather 3. So there might have been some residual Godfather 3 hate that followed this. But I know that one of the reasons the movie looks so cool and is he decided to do all the special effects in camera. So he actually went back and found like all of the old techniques that people would do in like the, you know, 40s and 50s horror films and employed them in this modern looking film. So that combined with the production design and also the fact that it's a modern film with modern actors makes it have this weirder sort of tension.
Yeah, and it very much it does have sort of an old Hollywood vibe to it, but with you know all of the sex and violence that you would expect from a modern movie.
Right.
And man, talk about some sex! Like
everyone's horny sex in this movie. Yeah,
yeah.
Everyone is writhing in some sort of like intense pleasure.
Those vampire wives at the beginning, oh my god, and it's just like, man, drinking blood has got to be the best.
all right, my turn next. Yeah, we're only on number five here. Let's go with another obvious one, but I think it's important to talk about, and that is David Fincher's Seven. This, I think, is the high watermark of the Silence of the Lambs ripoffs, of which there were many. This was the second film that David Fincher did after Alien 3. Alien 3 was sort of a disaster for him. He wanted to take his name off of it by the time it was done. But yeah, I think that what he gets to do here, again with the sort of noir genre, which the 90s was a big period of sort of that coming back. The way he kind of takes influence from something like the Giallo films from Italy, and he, again, another highly art-directed movie, as most David Fincher movies are, but this, you know, really gets into the set pieces, really gets into sort of dressing this hell-like landscape and cityscape. And, you know, if you just look at the plot, you know, like serial killer killing people by the tenants of the Seven Deadly Sins. Sounds kind of cheesy on paper.
It sounds like the most 90s plot
right.
for a horror movie.
And it, for a long time, I didn't watch it just for that reason. I was like, even as a whatever teen, I was like, that sounds kind of cheeseball. But watching it, I mean, it's David Fincher. He has that ability that no matter how pulpy the narrative is, he puts those meat hooks in you immediately, and you're transfixed into how this mystery unfolds. Really good performances, obviously, by Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman. And he kind of brings you into this battle of ideas, this what it becomes a battle of ideologies by the end of the movie, makes what could be super pulpy and silly psychologically taught. And it's a mystery that sort of drifts into horror because of the nature of these crimes and the way that he shoots the sort of the aftermath of them. It's just like one of the best mystery horror films ever, in my opinion. And he's a director who's done a lot of great films in a lot of different genres. And this is still his second film ever made, and probably he would say his first film. It's still very competitive with the rest of his body of work.
Yeah. So the first time I saw this movie, I really could not stand it. I thought it was abysmal. I've kind of come around on it. As an audience member, I think my viewpoint has matured a bit. It's undeniably a great movie. I had some issues with the bleakness of it, and that battle of ideology you were talking about.
Yeah.
But you know, that's what horror's supposed to do. It's supposed to as the kids say, make you shook. It definitely did that. So, it's a great movie. I can't It just, I don't know, I have a weird relationship with this movie.
No, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I mean, I came away liking it a whole lot, but it, I can see how its effectiveness almost can turn you off, because it is, well, it puts so you in a place where you're picking a side, and then, you know, the movie kind of pulls the rug out from under you.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's some. I do think the ending is a little exploitive, and I do think it's, I don't know, but it's effective, so.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm older and I have seen more of David Fincher's work, I can sort of pinpoint what he's doing a little better than the first time I saw it, when I was just like,
mm-hmm.
Who the fuck wants to make a movie that says that?
yeah.
You know, so I think now I've come to terms with a little more, because I do think it makes more sense in his body of work. Okay, I think I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball with this one. What number are we on?
This would be number 6, and I thought the last one was a curveball, but go ahead.
My next pick is Tremors.
Oh, okay. This didn't occur to me, but go ahead.
This is a sort of a horror comedy. Mm-hmm. It's the conceit of the movie, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is it's this, you know, dusty town, small town, population of like, you know, maybe 100.
Yes. Southwest. And, yeah.
Yeah. And it's, they start getting, the people of this town start getting eaten by these subterranean worm creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of becomes a Jaws on land.
Essentially.
And I think it's one of the better sort of movies that does that takes that Jaws formula and applies it in at least some interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got some of the best characters in it. It's so much fun. That's why this movie works. It's not the sandworms. It's not. It's because it takes this movie that essentially at the beginning sort of feels like a family comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then those characters have to deal with this really ridiculous extreme situation. And it's just, again, it sort of has that blockbustery, we're going to make a horror movie, but we're going to sort of trick people into liking it by making it as appealing as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And this spawned a lot of sequels, most of which were directed to DVD.
None of the sequels are worth talking about.
Yeah. I think I liked Tremors 2 when I was a kid. I don't know how well it stands up now. But
yeah, just watch the first one. I mean, that's the thing I think the original does well, is it treats the monsters as scary monsters. The humor doesn't come from the fact that it's like a bad sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
The humor comes from these really relatable, fun characters. In you know, when they die, it's sad. So Tremors, that's
fun.
It's scary. It's Jaws on land.
It's Jaws on land. It's a terrestrial Jaws. I do really appreciate this movie a lot. In fact, I will go on the record as saying it's my favorite B movie, because it's very much that.
Yeah.
And it's unabashedly that, but in almost kind of in what the same way that like Scream does for the slasher, you have this very self-aware stable of characters who, and I think the director and everybody involved kind of knows what movie they're making.
Mm-hmm.
It's referring to, especially in the character work and sort of the adventurous feel of it, feels a lot like Jaws. And obviously because you have this thing sort of underground and it's not easy to see and you can hide it for most of the movie and blah, blah, blah. In all those ways, it's a lot like Jaws. But it also is referring to sort of the atomic age creature features of the 50s as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm having a lot of fun doing that. It's really rewatchable, really great cast, good dialogue. It holds up.
All right, what's your next movie? Your number seven?
Yeah, I have two left.
So you have two left.
So I got to be a little judicious here.
I know you don't want another Shining.
Mishap, yeah. I think I got most of my big ones out of the way. I'm going to go with David Lynch's Lost Highway.
Damn it. I'm not saying damn it because you picked one of mine. I'm saying damn it because you didn't pick one of mine. And now you're going to be forced to pick one.
Yeah, I'm going to go with this one. David Lynch has never made, I think, what a lot of people would consider a straightforward horror film. Like, he's never done a film about a killer or a creature or something like that, where that's the focus of the movie. But all of his movies have some weird creepiness to them. And in fact, I didn't mention, and could have in my honorable mentions, I could have mentioned Eraserhead, because that is a movie that's beloved by a lot of horror fans, even though it's kind of more like his deconstruction of the American family done with gross meat puppets. But
I've never seen it, so I...
Oh, you should. I think that's October-y, and it's black and white, and it's weird, and yeah.
It's one of those ones that's been on my list for a while.
But I think Lost Highway is as close as he got to making a straight-up horror film. I saw a video essay a long time ago that was talking about David Lynch's L.A. trilogy, Lost Highway being the first, Mulholland Drive being the second, and Inland Empire being the third. And the way that the person sort of talked about it was Inland Empire is L.A. as heaven, Mulholland Drive is L.A. as purgatory, and Lost Highway is L.A. as hell, or Hollywood specifically. And it's a bit of a noir mystery thing kind of going on there as well. He's teaming up with his co-writer who he wrote Twin Peaks with. But yeah, so you have a lot of the same stuff that he does, doppelgangers and mystery people, like, you know, boogeyman characters who seem sort of otherworldly or supernatural in some sort of way. And, you know, plots that sort of deconstruct and come back together and timelines that are all over the place and possible multiple universes and all of this kind of crazy stuff that keeps people on the internet all night trying to figure out what they're about. And this is one of his more confounding films as far as that goes, but there has some of his best atmosphere, I think, in all of his films. And I think there's some really strong, creepy stuff. Yeah, in this movie, specifically with this mystery man character played by...
Robert Blake?
Yes, I think you're right.
I remember there being something weird about it because didn't Robert Blake end up killing his wife or something?
Or something. No.
Six when that happened.
Well, I mean, officially, no. There was always some... There was always
something. We don't need to go into it. Google Robert Blake.
Look up the TMZ stories. I'm sure they exist. But yes, the actor had issues where he was at some point a suspect for the murder of his wife. And in he stars as this kind of Mephistopheles devilish character here in white face, who seems to exist on all planes and universes in this movie and seems to be sort of behind the scenes of everything, sort of pulling the strings of these characters who are living out these Greek hells that they can't escape and reliving these tragedies over and over again or something to that effect. I'm a big Lynch fan, and I think this is like mainlining it. This is like if you're into what he does, you have to be pretty deep into his particular kind of narrative ideas and his atmospheres and that kind of stuff, because this is like all that.
I will say this is a cool looking film.
Oh yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think it was just a bit too confounding for me. I don't know. I agree with everything you're saying about atmosphere, but mm-hmm. I think this is also sort of David Lynch at his most frustrating.
Oh, not even close. I mean, I like this movie a lot. I love Mulholland Drive. I have a really hard time with Inland Empire. That one is
okay.
That one I would say is even more confounding than this. But I like I think this is also one of his better, like, noir kind of things, too. I mean, Blue Velvet, obviously. But, this movie is his darkest and weirdest. And, kind of timely, because it also deals specifically with a person who killed his wife. And this was released around the time of the OJ murder, or right after it. Mm-hmm. It seems like his most sinister film.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right, we got to speed this up. We haven't even gotten to our fucking reviews
yet. I know, that's happening at some point.
Uh-huh. All right, my next one. I think there's a good chance you're going to pick one of these two. So I'm going to say Jacob's Ladder.
That was a possibility, but I'm glad you picked it. Talk about it.
Yeah. So Jacob's Ladder, I didn't see till a little later, until our roommate Adam recommended it, because he was so into the Silent Hill games, that he heard that it was, some of their visual language was based off of this movie, so he was really interested in it. So I remember watching it just kind of expecting sort of a creature feature.
Yeah.
And ended up watching one of the most, like, psychologically fucking movies ever.
Yeah.
It makes you question, the very nature of reality. It sort of does the cosmic, philosophical horror of H.P. Lovecraft, but in a non-specific to H.P. Lovecraft way.
Yeah.
There's some really creepy visuals.
Mm.
Some of that, did I just see that out of the corner of my eye? Sort of, wait, what the fuck was that moment?
Yeah.
It's just a cool fucking movie. And a great performance by Tim Robbins. The ending is sort of an M. Night Shyamalan twist around.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's almost one of the a problem with the movie, because it does sort of rely on that twist so much. But overall, the movie is atmospheric and disturbing as hell. But also really good.
Yes, very good.
I'm running out of things to say.
No, fair enough. I like this movie a great deal. And again, I've watched it a lot. My only criticism of the movie is that I think ultimately it is a movie that's a little at odds with itself, because it wants to have a positive message. Like, it's a movie that thinks it's a movie about its positiveness, when it isn't. It's a movie that's actually much bleaker than its own making.
Yeah, I get that.
And
has a bit of a philosophical crisis.
Yeah, and there's some stuff in there about, like, the Vietnam War and that kind of stuff. And I think there's almost a little too much exposition. I actually would have liked this to take a little bit more kind of a Lynchian approach and tell us less. Because I think the mystery of it is almost more interesting than when you find out what's going on. But
I agree.
That said, I love the way it plays out. I love especially those early scenes when you're still unsure. I love, what you're saying, just the quick little glimpses into these hellish realities that kind of pop up and then go away just as fast.
I think it's one very of the startling. Best. I think as far as that goes, it has some of the best pacing,
mm-hmm.
to completely unsettle you.
Yeah.
Because it gets to the point where everything feels like it's normal, and then there's just like a little, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And it does that enough times, and it sort of builds on this really slow burn of uneasiness that it leaves you just sort of feeling a little icky,
yeah,
but in a good way.
And this was directed by Adrian Lyne, who up to that point had done films like Fatal Attraction, and he did the remake to Lolita. And this is kind of unlike those movies. I mean, this is much more otherworldly and fantastic, and but grounded in that sort of reality. And it has that kind of tactility that those movies do, that kind of sweaty tactility. But yeah, this is I think it's one of the most accomplished, like, psychological horror films. Yeah. Because it really puts you in a weird headspace.
Yeah, it's kind of a gut punch at the end, so.
Yeah.
All right. Is this your last pick?
Yeah, this is my last pick. And I am going to go with... Oh, man. This is...
I know. There's more from the 90s than I think you were giving it credit for.
No, I know. I know. I mean, we get to talk about the ones that we don't pick, so I'll just throw this one in there. I'll go with Misery.
Okay. Yep. That was between the two, between Jacob's Ladder and Misery. So I'm glad you picked that.
Yeah, and you still got another one, I guess. You know, there's a lot of Stephen King movies. There's a lot of movies based on his material, and up to this point, this is probably like peak Stephen King era, as far as people really caring about his work. And, you know, between something like 85
and now.
Well, now it's kind of a new era. It's kind of popping up again. But, you know, between like 85 to 92 is like when he was,
the king,
literally. And there's a lot of garbage made out of his his books.
That's also very true.
But peppered in there, there's some of the greatest horror films of all time when people actually get it. Rob Reiner did this one. This is his second adaptation. Lean on Me was based on a short story by Stephen King. But this one is this is a great, like, right time, right cast, right everything kind of movie. Mm-hmm. Right screenplay, right director who really understood what he was doing. He brings a very Hitchcockian vibe to the movie. I mean, there's obvious visual references to stuff like Rear Window, when you have James Caan in the wheelchair and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Sonnenfeld, who shot the film, he brings what he does to everything, which is a lot of fisheye lens and a lot of push-ins. But he does it to good effect here.
Not to mention one of the most terrifying and subtle performances and, like, movie villains.
Yeah. By Kathy Bates as the original Stan. And, you know, there's been some written about her as like, this is the beginning of, like, toxic internet fandom. is this portrayal.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. That's sort of the scary thing, is that's kind of where we're getting, is to where she's not as unreasonable. I don't know.
I mean, it's a big performance, you know. You say subtle. I would say maybe not necessarily. I think that the film does, and a lot like the way Carrie does, borders on camp.
What I mean, just
approaches that line to tipping off into campiness, but she appreciates the inherent humor in what she's doing, and she's a great comedian as well, if you've seen enough of Kathy Bates, as well as actresses who can do pretty much no wrong.
What I mean when I say subtle is, when I think of horror movie villains, I tend to think of, you know, the...
Dimensionality.
I tend to think of the horror icons, the Freddy Kruegers, the Leatherfaces, the ghost faces.
Yeah.
These sort of physical embodiments of violence.
Yeah.
And she isn't that. You know, she at first just is sort of this mousy fan. And so I guess that's what I mean when I say subtle, is not a subtle performance, but a subtle characterization of cruelty.
And insanity. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the way the movie ratchets that up more and more and more. And it's another kind of unsettling thing, because she's so good that even during the scenes where you know she's beyond fucked up, there's no, like, helping her, really. But acts the hell out of those scenes to put enough kind of humanity into what she's doing that you can almost like you can almost be put in the mindset of James Collins, like, maybe I can get out of this. Maybe I can talk her into doing the right thing. Like, there's a little bit of something there. She seems like a real enough person that maybe I can. And then obviously that's not the, how things turn out. But yeah, and you know, this is the claustrophobia of the movie because he's unable to move and it's snowing and he has to, you know, try and create these elaborate escape plots with almost no resources. And this is just a fantastic film.
There's also where it came from Stephen King's work. There's an interesting story there, and I think that's why it feels very real, is because it is sort of a reflection of a real moment that Stephen King had. Obviously, not specifically this, but.
Well, I think every author and every director, and I'm sure Rob Reiner had enough to draw from, this idea of like you're afraid to disappoint your fans because you're known for this thing, and
you can feel the anxiety coming through it. Yeah, it's so genuine, and I think maybe that's why it registers. You know, is sure we all have that sort of primal fear of the person with the knife chasing us. But this feels just a little more relatable to the source.
Yeah.
You know, it feels a little more lived, if that makes sense.
For sure.
All right. So I guess I'm going to cap off the 90s now with, I'll go with the other vampire movie, the other big dog, I think, from the 90s. And that's Interview with the Vampire.
Okay, yeah. Now, this is the one I thought you were going to say last time.
And I actually just rewatched this movie like a week ago.
Yeah.
And totally holds up.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a good movie. It's romance. It's got all the things that I mentioned with Dracula. But the story is a little more grounded, a little more relatable than Dracula. And it's a love story. It's about a very dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of done through the veil of a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one of Tom Cruise's best performances.
Oh, where for sure.
Really gets to chew some scenery, pun intended. I mean, he's really vamping it up, pun intended.
Yes.
But he's great. He's so charismatic. And he plays off of Brad Pitt perfectly.
Like,
mm-hmm. Kristen Stewart.
Yeah.
Not Kristen Stewart.
Kirsten Dunst.
Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah.
Thank you. Really showing her chops in a way I don't think she's done since.
Yeah, she's weirdly regressed as she's gotten older. Like,
yeah. But anyway, it's a gorgeous movie. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most romantic interpretations of vampire. And it's also sad, you know, it's kind of a bummer of a movie.
Yeah, it kind of plays with this idea of living eternally, which I think that's a thing that like no vampire movie up to that point had really done. I mean, you had like things like Dark Shadows, the television series and whatever, and people would talk about living eternally. But nobody had ever like shown this grand epic through the decades.
Not the tortured curse either.
Right,
Usually, living forever, I think up to this point was presented as like
a positive.
Yeah. I do think this movie could maybe you could almost maybe blame it as the genesis for stuff like Twilight.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think Anne Rice, the successes of her novels and the Vampire Chronicles and all of that stuff. She was the first one who really like made these sensitive vampires.
But I think in this movie it still works, even though I think it's borderline not a horror movie.
Borderline. Yeah.
I think she, or at least the movie makes it work, because even though they are sensitive creatures, you never lose sight of the fact that they are horrible killers.
Yeah, and they have to be.
That it's bred into them that they.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And again, another one that's really great about production design and costume design. I love the sort of like 1800s, 1700s, like New Orleans thing. Like you can kind of
I love the part where Brad Pitt comes out of his fucking plantation home and he's like yelling at his slaves to run away because he's the devil.
Like, yeah, and they're doing like voodoo spells to get rid of to ward off evil.
There's also some great set pieces in this movie.
Yeah, this is directed by Neil Jordan, and he brings a lot of like before this he did the movie The Crying Game, is sort of what he got well known for. But he brings a sort of an emotional reality to this movie, to the fantasy aspect of this movie, and I love just the epic feel of it.
Yeah. It's
this world of like, vampires, you know.
It's like Gone with the Wind with vampires.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, that's it. That is all of the horror films of the 90s. I'm going to read through these again before we rattle off our honorable mentions, but I came in with Silence of the Lambs. You came in with Scream. I mentioned Audition. You with Bram Stoker's Dracula. I came in with Seven. You brought up Tremors, Lost Highway, Jacob's Ladder, Misery, and Interview with the Vampire. A very strange, varied list. And I thought that that's kind of how this would go. What are some movies we didn't get to talk about that you would have?
So there's, like I said, there were like five vampire movies on my list. So mm-hmm. I'm just going to rattle off the other vamps that didn't quite make the cut.
Mm-hmm.
From Dusk Till Dawn, super fucking cool movie. Even though this is more of a superhero movie, I'm still throwing it in there. Blade.
Okay.
That's why it didn't make the cut ultimately. And sort of similar, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
For horror comedy. Yeah,
it's a little too much on the comedy edge for me.
Yeah.
To consider it, you know, fully a horror movie. So that's the vampire stuff. I have a couple more, but I want you to get some in there, too, before I just rattle off everything.
Okay. Another vampire movie you neither of us brought up but could have, Kronos, the Guillermo del Toro film.
Oh, fuck, yeah.
I really almost mentioned this all throughout the list, but never committed to it. Candyman, the original.
I'm excited to see what Jordan Peele does
with that. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think it's one of those ones that it's sort of on the cusp of that tired slasher genre. I feel like the story of that one is so good, but it's just so 90s.
It is. I do think that the first one is a lot more intelligent than people give it credit for, because it's talking about race in really interesting ways that no horror movie that up to that point, I think, really did. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool. I like that movie a lot. I have Dead Alive, neither of us talked about.
Oh, yeah.
From Peter Jackson. I have Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which is, you know, that was him sort of like getting into that whole metatextual thing before Scream. Like it's sort of a lead up to that. I also have From Dusk Till Dawn. Neither of us brought up The Sixth Sense. One of the biggest horror movies of the decade, nominated for Best Picture, I think won Best Screenplay.
I don't know.
Really care. It's kind of tired now. Yeah, it's like
I just don't really care for that movie, but I
think it has effective horror scenes still, but you know, we've had so many bad Shyamalan movies since then, it's just hard to talk about. Blair Witch, you can't deny how influential that movie is. Even though the movie is kind of quaint in by today's standards.
That's why I didn't make my list, is because I still haven't seen it. So
I saw it only last year, but yeah, certainly super influential. And I think that's the only thing on here that we didn't talk about.
Cool. The only other ones that I think are worth mentioning. I flirted with the idea of Jurassic Park. I just think it's too much of a blockbuster to really be a horror movie.
Yeah, I kind of put that in the same world as Aliens.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of tips the scales in a way that Jaws doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this might be the last good Tim Burton movie. I really enjoy his version of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, very not like the source material at all. But that's a fun one.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, that was long, but we are going to talk about these other movies. We might just have a jumbo episode here. But let's go ahead and start talking about Bad Times at the El Royale. Do you want me to set that up?
Sure.
So this is written and directed by Drew Goddard, who did Cabin in the Woods. And now he's probably most well-known for having done the Netflix Daredevil series. He's a showrunner on that. He comes from the J.J. Abrams Lost world. And I think he kind of brings that element of sort of the mystery box to this film. I knew nothing about this going in. Like, nothing. The trailers were very, very smart about not giving away too much plot detail, although I don't know how smart, because I don't think the movie's doing all too well. But you know, it's a very big cast. This has everyone you know in it, including Jeff Bridges, Dakota Johnson, John Hamm, Chris Hemsworth shows up at some point. Nick Offerman has a little part in there. And it kind of starts out with a bunch of strangers coming to this hotel that's in the middle of Tahoe, right? Lake Tahoe?
It's like on the outskirts of Tahoe, yeah.
Yeah.
On the Nevada-California border.
Right, and it's sort of a gimmick hotel where half of the hotel is in California and half of the hotel is in Nevada, and you can choose to stay on either side, and they have different state rules, like things cost different things on depending on which side you're on. But yeah, you learn very quickly that all of these people have ulterior motives. They're not exactly telling the truth as far as who they are, why they're there. And, you know, this is a movie, it's going to be a little hard to review because I enjoyed not knowing anything. And I enjoyed how this movie unfolded slowly. And I had a kind of an interesting arc critically with the movie because for about the first 20 or so minutes, I wasn't so into it. I thought it was cool looking, and I like kind of the late 60s, early 70s, like, vibe of the movie, and the camera work was really cool, but I thought, this is really stylish, but I don't know if I care. But then, as I learned more and more about these characters, and as they reveal themselves to us, and the plot is kind of constructed in a sort of nonlinear, very Tarantinian way, I think that's a name that might come up a lot during this review, once the movie sort of coalesced, I really, really, really came around to it to the point where I'm like, this could be one of my favorite movies of the year, short a few things and we'll get to them.
Okay. No, I agree with everything you're saying. Like, at the beginning, it's sort of so obtuse that it's like, okay, I know something weird's going on. And then it just, but it's a very patient movie.
Yeah, this is almost 2.5 hours, and it uses every minute.
Yeah, and but I never found it dull. You know, a lot of time, a 2.5 hour movie, like, short of something like The Avengers, where they're just cramming everything they can in.
Yeah.
You know, that can be a death sentence for my attention span.
Yeah.
I know it was something that Ashley was concerned about. She's like, you know, this is like 2.5 hours, and I was like, no. Okay.
Yeah.
But I never found myself bored. And in the beginning, there's enough little dangles for me to be like, okay, you know, sort of those promises of mysteries.
Yeah.
And then as it sort of gets on its feet, I was actually appreciative that it took its time getting there.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, okay, there's payoff to this. That's good. Yeah, definitely Tarantino vibes. I also got some Coen Brothers-y vibes.
Yeah, specifically stuff like Barton Fink.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that kind of darker sort of quirkiness going on there.
And it's not quite as snappy as a Tarantino film. It's not quite as intentionally cool. I mean, the shots are very slick, but the dialogue isn't like hyper stylized. No.
Originally, I think more for me when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about structure largely.
Yeah.
The way that the movie's kind of split up in chapters, we learn about a character in every chapter, and then it kind of comes back around to, you know, going from flashback into flash forward and how the movie kind of builds. Look of it.
And kind of the look of it with this, you know, sort of a hyper stylized period.
Yeah, and you have the needle drops and then that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, I found myself totally digging this movie. Once I got an idea of sort of who these characters were, I thought they were all really unique, and the story, I think, evolves in some pretty cool ways.
Yeah, it takes some really interesting turns. Very risky stuff. Like, it's almost seems like a writing exercise where, you know, he kind of comes to a point where the traditional movie would do this, so he purposely decides to do the other thing.
Yeah.
And then see if he can get himself out of that.
I also think there's a lot of show don't tell in this movie, which is something I really like. You get to sort of this point with a character where you could reveal it in expository dialogue, but instead we get sort of a 5-minute flashback sequence, which sort of I think also sort of harkens back to the Lost idea of, you know, let's see where these characters came from instead of just them saying it. And I think that worked.
That sort of mystery box approach. Yeah. We'll tease this and then see how long we can keep your interest. And then we'll reveal that. But we're also going to add a new question while doing it. And I think that you can even see some elements of Cabin in the Woods here. Of this idea of this kind of like voyeuristic thing that's going on, and these people kind of looking into a world and people unaware of what's going on.
And it's not as on the nose as Cabin in the Woods, but you know, there's a little bit of a deconstruction to the way thrillers play out.
Yeah, this has a little bit of like, it's kind of a noir thing going on here, but there's also sort of a Agatha Christie-ish vibe to this as well, or like a darker version of the movie Clue or something.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you said that. It did kind of remind me a lot of Clue in the first little bit of it. You sort of feel like everybody's got a secret. I got those vibes for sure. So you said, you know, there were some issues that sort of are holding you back from this movie. What you want to elaborate on any of that?
Yeah, I do. I think this movie is really entertaining, and I loved the experience of it. And I for that alone, I think it's probably going to crack my top 10, if, you know, depending on how the year shakes out. However, the ambition of the film is huge. You know, Drew Goddard is trying to make the great American film here.
Sure.
You know, especially once we get into the Chris Hemsworth stuff, and like he's sort of building upon a theme more and more and more, and he's making this grand narrative. Ultimately, what is it about, in quotation marks?
I think that there are some thematic things at play there that I don't want to get into too much.
You could say there's a little bit of the theme of redemption that pops up more than once.
I think you can also, I think that the secrecy is sort of intentional, playing off of the Americana aspect of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that there are characters that are intentionally, there's definitely an intention to which characters are telling the biggest lies.
Okay.
And yeah. And the way that's cast out.
And this is stuff that could reveal itself upon repeat viewings.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there is enough subtext there to sink your teeth into later on. I want to watch it again because I think there's some just cool stuff, the way stuff is revealed.
Yeah. I mean, hot take maybe, but I think this movie accomplishes better what I think Hateful Eight was going for.
I kind of agree with you.
I like Hateful Eight a lot, but I think that movie almost gets too mired in its speechifying and dialogue sequences that yeah, this movie sort of this pulls one back a little.
I agree.
And it's a little better at suspense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That is one thing this movie's great at. It definitely knows when to change the chapter.
Yeah.
I liked Hateful Eight a lot, but mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think this sort of does the tension of a group of strangers.
Yeah.
And I think even though they're pretty similar in length, I think this movie is a bit more effective in the way it uses its time.
Agreed.
I think you can say, there are moments of The Hateful Eight that are a bit self-indulgent. And I think that this movie is a lot more economical with its 2.5-hour runtime.
Yeah, and I think that it there's never anything in there that I feel is padding anything out. Everything feels more intentional.
My only real complaint with the movie, because I have a little bit of an issue.
Okay.
I don't know if this is spoilery, so I'll try to be vague. But I feel like the promise of Chris Hemsworth's character, I don't think it's too spoiler to say he comes in a little bit later.
Yeah.
He's so built up that I think it's very hard for that promise to totally pay off with what we see.
Okay.
There was, with his character specifically, I felt like there was some things being held back a little bit. And I think there were times when it was very effective, and that there were times when it was just the ending itself was a little more expected.
Well, yeah, and I think this happens with Hateful Eight too, but it comes to a point where it's like, well, now nothing can really happen, but everyone's going to start, murdering. like it gets to a point where there's all this intrigue and interesting stuff, and the plot's going in all these interesting directions, and then it just kind of has to, the tension has to snap at some point. And I think, again, I think this movie does that in a more interesting way. And I liked the Chris Hemsworth character because I felt like he was sort of this kind of deconstruction of this, there's definitely a Charles Manson thing going on there, but there's also Charles Manson as the rock and roll sex god Jim Morrison thing?
Well, Charles Manson as Charles Manson saw himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked the character. I just... there was something about the ending that felt... I don't know. I don't know how to describe it exactly. That felt a little bit like maybe there were a couple of checks that were written that weren't quite cashed.
Okay. Yeah.
But other than that, and even that is pretty small, really. Mm-hmm. Because overall, I just really had a lot of fun with this movie.
So did me too. I kept leaning in further and further, like, okay, movie, okay.
It was... At the beginning, I was like, okay, sort of impress me. And then I was like, oh, holy shit, you are.
Yeah. And then, again, I knew nothing about this movie going in. And seeing the characters and stuff in the trailers and stuff, I'm like, this is either going to be really good or terrible. Like, there's no way this can be only okay.
For sure. All right. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, we didn't bring her up, but Cynthia Erivo as Darlene Sweet. She's great. I know very little about her as an actress, but she is one of my favorite characters in the movie. She plays, you know, kind of the moral center of the thing, and she's great. And a great singer, and yeah, love it.
It's a great cast altogether. I mean, even Dakota Johnson.
Yeah, best I've seen her yet.
Absolutely.
And used a really interesting effect.
And I think she really needed to be in a movie like this.
Yeah. Lewis Pullman, who plays the dorm or the desk man or whatever you want to call him, he has a really interesting arc in the movie, and he does some incredible acting in here.
All right. Letter grade time.
Oh boy. I'm going to go A- on this.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I think I'm going to give it an A.
Solid A.
Straight up A. Yeah. I was solidly impressed.
Yeah, me too. And Drew Goddard, like, you know, keep an eye out on him because he's doing good stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, let's wrap it up quickly with the Netflix homework of The Void, and I will let you describe what that movie is.
Okay. The Void, essentially, this police officer picks up a guy on the side of the road who's in some trouble, has to take him to a nearby hospital. A hospital that's all but been abandoned, but it's the closest one. So he has to take him there where the cop's ex-wife is working. And then as they...
Kind of in the sticks, right?
Yeah, as he arrives, it gets surrounded by these mysterious cult figures, and then monsters start attacking them.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I heard it was all right. Here's the thing. It's, to me, this movie felt like, you know, it's a direct-to-DVD, you know, trying to do Lovecraft. Just watch Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah,
honestly,
there's a lot of stuff there. There's a lot of like sub Hellraiser going on in this movie as well.
Yeah, but ultimately, I think the thing is just sort of mired by the inconsistent acting performances, and the general sort of cheapness feeling of it. I mean, there's some cool monster effects.
Yeah, the practicals for the most part are pretty good.
Yeah, and I think as a short story, you know, on paper, this might have worked a little better for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the conceit is fine. I don't know. It just kind of feels like a cheesy, you know, direct-to-DVD horror movie.
Yeah, I kind of got the same effect from it. And, I mean... It almost kind of won me over towards the end. Like, it was really close to, like, me giving it a pass rather than a fail. Ultimately, I'm giving it a fail. But I...
No, I actually agree with you, because the beginning, I was like, oh boy, here we go. because the characters are pretty dreadfully written,
yeah,
for the most part. And, again, the acting performances, some of the actors are decent,
mm-hmm.
But overall they're a bit scattered.
Yeah, they feel a little underdirected. The actors, from scene to scene, you're right. It's inconsistent. Like, sometimes they seem fine, and then other times they don't. I almost feel like this movie is made by two different directors. Like, there's one director who's pretty good who gets to direct about 25% of the scenes.
Yeah.
And then there's another director who's just kind of bad and schlocky, and he's doing the rest of the movie. But every once in a while, a scene would happen where I was like, okay, now I'm a little more interested. And, you know, yeah, I think the aesthetics are cool. I like the monster effects. I like sort of this hell world that they create, and sort of the fantasy rules of the movie. The stuff you can tell this guy is way more interested in than, yes, like, oh, and I got to direct these actors. I got to, like, block a scene. I got to do all this movie bullshit. I just want to show off my monsters.
I think the movie would have been better had he just kind of done that.
Yeah.
It feels like the script is like, okay, we have to, you know, we have set to all set these this things up.
Yeah.
And I think it could have been better if it was just sort of trippy weirdness.
Yeah, and it slips into that at a point, and that's kind of when I started to care a little bit more. The main issue is I just don't like any of these characters. And it's a movie that you have to kind of be with them to care all the way through.
I think my issue with that is I never really felt like I was watching characters. I felt like I was watching actors trying to play characters. So, you know, even at the end, the main guy kind of wins me over by the end.
Mm. Yeah.
But I'm just never convinced he's a real person.
Yeah. He always seems...
I'm just like, oh, you've gotten better as an actor.
Yeah, by the end of the movie, he was doing really good.
Yeah.
No, I same here. It's ultimately a schlock. The plot construction, too, it kind of feels a little bit like a horror survivor game. It's a little bit of like, we're going to go down this corridor and then, this happens. And then we're going to move further into this corridor and then that.
I just think ultimately it was fine. It wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just so many other movies that
do this better.
This subject so much better. Jacob's Ladder,
Hellraiser.
Hellraiser. Holy shit, yeah.
The movie that we talked about last year, Baskin, I think is doing a lot of this.
Yeah, but in, I think, way more effective ways.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I wouldn't really recommend this unless you just want kind of a dumb, but decently effective monster movie to watch with some friends.
Yeah, if you're really into practical effects and monster makeup and that kind of stuff, if you like Gru and gore, and you've seen all the Hellraiser movies and you need another one, sure.
You know,
it's mostly not a good movie. It's mostly bad.
I feel like this is probably better. Better, if not on par with the quality of some of the later, like, Hellraiser sequels.
Yeah, it's about, like, Hellraiser 4 and on. It's like Hellraiser Bloodline level good.
Yeah. Oh my god, have you, I'm clicking through the pictures on IMDb right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some amazing posters that it's so clear that they, like, had sort of concept and art design for this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, look at these posters. They're fucking gorgeous.
Yeah. And you can tell that the this person was raised on, like, 80s rubber and that kind of stuff. PVC monsters. Like, that's his bread and butter. And you can tell that he loves that kind of stuff. And you can tell, like, he's really into the rules and the mythology of the movie. All of that's way more interesting than the stuff that makes a movie, which is, like, characters.
Yeah. And I mean, who knows? I think this might be their first movie. I don't know.
Yeah. Jeremy Gillespie maybe. And Stephen Konstanky. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, so who knows? Maybe we'll get something good out of them someday that we'll be like, oh yeah, that was those guys.
Maybe. Okay, so next week for the last Halloween episode we do for October, in the Netflix homework, we're going to talk about the infamous horror film Teeth.
Wait, this is the last horror one?
Yeah, because after that... the by Thursday of the week after will be in November.
Well, I might throw another horror one at you since we're supposed to do a month of this shit.
So we'll be talking about the movie Teeth, and we'll also be doing our draft of the 2000s. And okay, so if anybody has anything they want to say about this episode, if you want to disagree with our lists, or if you want to chime in on your thoughts on the movies we talked about here, you can do so at our email at jabberandrone@gmail.com. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Casts, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. You can find us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can also find us on Instagram at Jabber Podcast. You can find me individually on Twitter at BC Cassidy, V as in Victor. And you can also read my reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. And you can read a review I just posted up today on the MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy, a documentary on the heavy metal subculture grindcore. What's your stuff?
You can follow me on... I'm basically done with Twitter, so fuck that. You can follow me if you want, but whatever. I think I might deactivate my account soon. I've been trying to do more on Instagram, though. Follow me on that Insta, at Keith Foster Kid. Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. Hopefully I have some new shows to announce soon. I'll let you know more about that when there's more to know. But we do have one more vampire romance book club to do at Old Town Improv Company in San Diego. It's going to be Saturday, October 27th at 9 p.m. Book Club presents Vampire Romance. The last show we did was a lot of fucking fun. There were vampires. There were werebears. It was cool. So come check that out before October's over. Get in that vampire goodness. Yeah.
All right. Be sure to check out our other friends who do podcasts. Dennis and Patrick over at Almost Educational. Rod and Moksha over at The Listening Party. When and if either of those decide to do more episodes. They don't. By the end of the year, I'm going to stop saying your podcast names.
That's a threat called out.
That is a threat. And
the gauntlet is thrown.
Check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast. I've just been re-invited to go do another episode with them. It's going to be a little ways away, so I'm not going to announce what album we talk about until then, but it's a good one. What else? Mike Falick over at Hack Thought, and Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. And Alice has another one called Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast.
That's fun.
All right. And you have a couple, too?
Yeah. Check out Adam Connie and the Adamant podcast and Campfire Shit Show with Bo and Merrill.
All right. That is the episode.
God damn it. I didn't have a thing. Shit. Just go see Bad Times at the El Royale.
Yeah, he needs help.